Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the limited liability story when we come back. Well, welcome to Tax Freedom Day. That occurs about May 12th every year. That means you work all of January, February, March, April, and a third of May to pay your income tax for the year. And that's not all. Now you can work the rest of May and all of June to pay the rest of your withholding taxes. This income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal enterprises, and the income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank. The income tax and Social Security tax also violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Scriptures, including our English common law. Now, 14 million Americans are not enrolled in Social Security, and more are opting out every day. Now, I contend you owe it to yourself to at least ask this question: do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Why don't you call or write today for our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. You know, Jesus never paid a tax to bail, and neither should we. If you'd like to order that free general law CD package, just call direct and order yours today by asking for it. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we're talking about limited liability. Now, limited liability means insurance. Insurance is commerce by definition. So we engage in commerce, known in the Bible as Canaanite trafficking, when we engage in commercial activities. And commerce is generally recognized as business that we do with commercial paper, things like mortgages, deeds of trust, Federal Reserve notes, paper money. Any time that you're dealing in paper, in promises, as opposed to substance or property, is commerce. Business is divided in Anglo-Saxon administration into two forms. It's commercial or it's private. Private business is carried on in substance or property like gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. We sometimes think of it in terms of barter. And commerce comes into play, and we can facilitate our trades by writing checks and using credit cards. It's the same system that was developed by the merchants of the Hanseatic League in Hamburg, Germany in 1536. They all recognized that it was hazardous shipping on the seas and all, and so they took a look at some cases that came down where they had the gold and the goods on the ship, and when the ship sinks, you lose the goods and the gold. So they came to the conclusion that it might be better if we all of us agreed to put our gold over here in a central location, in a vault, in the hands of the merchants. Today we call them bankers. Then we will ship the goods on the ship, and if the ship sinks, we don't lose the gold with it. We suffer a loss, but we don't suffer the loss of both our money and the goods. Today, international trade is carried on that way. There's a bank vault on 42nd Street in Manhattan, down under the ground, six stories. And when a ship pulls into Brazil, they go down to the vault where they've got all these countries with gold bars, you know, sitting in their accounts. And so the Brazilians have to take some gold bars out of their account and stick it over in the Saudi Arabian account or somebody else's account. And then when a ship of load of bananas arrives over in Saudi Arabia, they take some gold out of the Saudi Arabian account and they move it over to the Brazilian account. And that's the way they keep track of their balance of payments, is move these gold bars back and forth. They don't actually, you know, ship gold, you know, from Brazil across the ocean to Saudi Arabia and then ship the gold back from Saudi Arabia. The more you ship this across the ocean back and forth, the more chance there is that the ship is going to sink and you're going to lose the gold. And they didn't want to do that. Now, this gave rise also to maritime underwriting. You know, not all ships sink, only one in 100. So the guy that loses his goods on the ship suffers. He takes it in the shorts. And so they came up with a system whereby what we'll call this is a Tontine wagering scheme. But today we don't call it Tontine wagering. We call it insurance and underwriting. We have better names for it today. And that way, when a ship sinks, then a company like Lloyd's of London jumps into the breach and pays the guy that lost. Actually, he's the winner. Yeah, the guy whose ship sinks and loses all of his goods, he's the winner, and he gets paid the check out of the pool. Now, this pool has to be administered, and there have to be profits made so that the people that are administering it can get paid for it. And pretty soon they figured out, hey, this is a pretty good deal. It's kind of like playing a crap table. You know, the house doesn't make any money on the bets directly. They're not sitting there trying to, you know, shake the dice and make sure it comes up a 7 or 11. They don't care what number it comes up, because on average, the dice are going to come up on a particular number so many times out of 36. So what they do is they craftily engineer the payouts so that, let's take the field for instance, if you were to bet a dollar on 12, the chances of a 12 coming up are 1 in 36, every 36 throws of the dice. And if they paid you 36 to 1 and you threw the dice 10,000 times, the 12 would come up 277 times, you'd get paid 36 to 1, and you'd come out even, and the house would come out even. So in order for the house to make a little money, they don't pay you 36 to 1, they pay you a little bit less than that. They pay you 30 to 1. And by paying you 30 to 1, they take 6 points, or 16%. So throw the dice now 10,000 times, and they will pay you 30 to 1, 277 times, and they'll take 16% of the $10,000 bet. That's the way they make their money. That's the way insurance companies make their money. It's actually a game of percentages. And the insurance companies have staffs and computers and statisticians, and they just sit around all day long drinking coffee, pinching the girls, and drinking water at the water cooler, and working the numbers so that they can maximize their profit based upon the statistical chances or the law of averages. Insurance, in reality, is a big gambling casino. It's kind of like the stock market. It's a big gambling casino. Now, we have to have customers come into our casino and play, so we have to teach and train you to do this, and this is why we need public schools. Public schools fulfill the need of educating the public to their perceived need of doing business with banks, having credit cards, buying insurance, and voting. Now, we train our customers from childhood. We take little children in, age 5, and we put them through a public educational system. I call it a public brainwashing system. And the reason that I call it brainwashing is because nobody ever presents the other side of the coin. Nobody ever presents the alternative to insurance. So that's why this week I thought, well, let's take a look at insurance, limited liability, and let's look at the other side of it, and then make an intelligent decision. I'm not here telling you not to buy insurance. I'm suggesting that you look at insurance as a gambling casino, a statistical law of averages that is immensely profitable for the people that are running the casino, and your chances of getting paid or collecting your premiums back are near zero. Not quite zero. Now, there's winners, just like the lottery. See, if the lottery took your money and there were no winners, zero, nobody would play the lottery. If the insurance company took your premiums and then never paid out anything, hell, nobody would buy insurance. So by paying out some of the time and then making a big scene over it so that you can see, look at the lucky winner over here, collected $10,000. All he did was put a quarter in the slot machine, won the big jackpot, $10,000. So we conveniently fail to tell you this guy put in $15,000 worth of quarters to win $10,000. But it is true, it was just one quarter that he put in that won the $10,000. So they're not lying to you. They're just not telling you the whole story. That's why I thought this week we ought to bring the rest of the story out, as old Paul Harvey used to say, you know, here's the rest of the story. Now, the side that you hadn't heard before. Now, there's a perception out here, for instance, that we need to get drunk drivers off the highways. Have you heard that? Drunk drivers need to be taken off the highway. Well, for most of you people, you don't ever remember a time when drunk drivers used to drive on the highways, and they were totally unmolested. Now, my dad drove, and he drove quite often, and he drove drunk quite often. In fact, I'm not sure that my dad drove sober very often at all. And my dad never did have an accident while he was drunk. In fact, he only had one or two accidents, period, but he never had an accident when he was drunk, which demonstrates that some drunk drivers are pretty safe drunk drivers. But it is also true that drunk drivers sometimes have accidents, and these accidents sometimes kill people. But it is also true that sober drivers kill more people than drunk drivers. Your chances of being killed in an automobile accident aren't very good to start with. And your chances of being killed by a drunk driver aren't very good at all. And if you're going to get killed driving on the highway, your chances of being killed by a sober driver are 5 times greater than they are in being killed by a drunk driver. Now, I don't see any big campaign out there to ban sober drivers from the highway, but I thought that I would start a movement today. Now, furthermore, it's a statistical fact that in New Mexico, people who are killed more often by other drivers who have dark hair and dark eyes. It's just a statistical fact in New Mexico. Now, I would propose then that we eradicate all dark-haired, dark-eyed people from driving on the roads of New Mexico, and it would cut traffic accidents in New Mexico and deaths by 95%. Absolutely guaranteed. Now, somebody's going to say, yeah, but nearly all the people in New Mexico have dark hair and and dark eyes. Hey, I could take you up to North Dakota. And then we have another statistical anomaly here. Most of, that is 95% of the accidents in North Dakota are caused by blonde, blue-eyed people. So in North Dakota, if we could eradicate all of the blonde, blue-eyed people from the highways, we could virtually eliminate death and accidents from the highways of North Dakota. Now somebody's going to say, yeah, but all those people up there are Scandinavians and Germans, and they have blonde hair and blue eyes. And I said, well, it proves my point. Those are the people that are killing people. Yeah, but that doesn't have anything to do with their driving skills. Neither does drunk driving. Let me tell you a little story here. Down in New Mexico, this is many years ago now, but down in New Mexico, there was an old farmer driving a 1948 GMC pickup. And he's drunk. He's going home, and he's driving up the road, and he's just drunk. I don't know how drunk he was. But for the point of our story is he's drunk, which is all that's required here. Furthermore, he had a pint of whiskey in his pocket, in his back pocket. He's sitting in his pickup. He's got a pint of whiskey. He's been drinking out of this pint. Now, coming in the opposite direction from Los Angeles, on his way to Disney World in Orlando, Florida, is a doctor and his wife and his two blonde, blue-eyed daughters. Yeah, you can see the plot thickening right here, can't you? And the doctor is driving along, and it's about, I think if I remember right, it was about 11 to 11:30 at night. And it was just west of Albuquerque, New Mexico, up on the flat. You know, not going up the hill now, but out on the flat there. And back in those days, it wasn't a four-lane highway. There was a two-lane highway now. I think this is back in the 60s or something. And the doctor fell asleep at the wheel. He had been driving all the way from Los Angeles, and he's tired. He falls asleep at the wheel, crosses the center line, and hits this farmer head on. And it kills the doctor, kills his wife and the two children. Now, the drunk came out of the wreck pretty good. He got banged up a little bit, but he didn't get killed. And so the drunk driver, you know, once he was apprehended there, he was arrested, prosecuted, and jailed for 10 years for drunk driving. And they charged him with vehicular homicide. Why? Because he's drunk. It's against the law to drive drunk. Now, did the courts make a mistake? No. The law says you can't drive drunk, period. He's driving drunk. He's in violation of the law. He's got a driver's license. He's in a regulated enterprise. And did he cause the accident? No, he didn't cause the accident. Was he the victim of someone who did cause the accident? Yeah, he was. Did he collect anything from the doctor's estate? Not a dime. Was he punished for his drunk driving? Yeah. The theory behind it is, see, if he'd have been obeying the law, he wouldn't have been there for the doctor to hit. Now, the doctor may have gone on into a ditch, rolled over three times, threw everybody out of the car and killed him. We don't know how the accident would have come out. In this case, the GMC pickup was right in front of the doctor when he fell asleep, so he crossed the center line and he killed himself and his wife. But it points out my thesis very well here, that you don't have to be the cause of the accident to be punished. You just have to be a member of the regulated enterprise, and as a member of the regulated enterprise, the farmer had promised that he wouldn't drive drunk, so he drove drunk. He's in breach of contract. He's going to prison for his breach of contract, not causing the accident. So that's one of the side effects that you get from insurance, limited liability, joining the club. Most people don't know that, but now you do. It's kind of like joint and several liability, you know, on a debt. Did you know that you are responsible for all of the debt in the event that the other principals who are higher on the scale than you are don't pay? You have to pay all of them. As we saw in South Tucson, Arizona, if you remember the story about the police officer who won a $3.5 million judgment, the city of South Tucson can't pay, so they go into bankruptcy court and file for bankruptcy. Bankruptcy judge says, no, you can't come in here and file for bankruptcy. You get assets. What assets do we have? We got city hall, fire departments, police departments, fire engines, police cars. And if that isn't enough, then we'll just start selling people's houses. Because the people's houses represent the collateral of the underwriters, known as taxpayers, who have joint and several liability on the city's debts because they're a member of the club. Now, stockholders in a corporation don't have joint and several liability. So when a corporation like General Motors goes bankrupt, you lose your investment, but you don't have to pay the debts. That's a little perk. That's a little benefit. Under the common law, if you were holding these stock certificates, the common law, the law of God brought down from Moses, would require that you pay all of those debts, joint and several liability, just like a taxpayer in a municipal corporation. Hey, isn't this contract thing just fun? That's why when you go to sign up in some way, when you sign your name at the bottom of a page, always remember this. Every time you sign your name, you are impairing your liberty to some degree. So A common law free man, and let's assume that this guy is a common law, practicing the Ten Commandment model, free man, and he has never been to school, can't write his name, can't read, can't do jack diddly squat. He's born, lives to be 110, never signs his name a single time in 110 years. And that's exactly correct. He should never sign his name a single time, because every time you do, you impair your liberty to some degree. You are promising somebody specific performance to some degree. Does that mean we should never sign a contract? I don't think so. I sign contracts every once in a while. When there's something that I want from you, and there's something that you want from me, we enter into a bilateral agreement. And you tell me, well, here's what I'm going to give you, and I tell you, well, here's what I'm going to give you. And in the process, we both limit our freedoms to some degree during the period or the operation of this contract. You have to work for me. I have to work for you. So in this period when I'm working for you, I can't be doing something else. I have to dedicate my time to you, and you have to dedicate your time to me. And that's so that we can both achieve our goals. There's something that we want. But during this period of time, I have impaired my liberty to some degree. And now I can't go fishing because now I have to stay here in class and teach class. And you've impaired your liberty. Now you have to attend class, so you can't be working or going to Disneyland. So it's a bilateral agreement. Now, an adhesion contract isn't bilateral, it's unilateral. Well, it's unilateral from the point of view, it's the company General Electric that writes the contract. It's bilateral from the point of view that you sign the warranty card in total ignorance as to the terms and conditions of the contract. So the contract is written unilaterally, it's agreed to bilaterally, and then when you plug the toaster in and kill yourself and your widow says, well, I'm going to collect wrongful death from General Electric, they bring up the contract and say, oh, no. Little Georgie over here agreed to hold us harmless in the event that he plugged the toaster in and killed him and limits our liability to the repair or the replacement of the toaster at our option. That's what a warranty does. A warranty is in fact, a guarantee, but it's more than a guarantee. It's a bilateral agreement that you don't even know what the terms are. Well, now you've been warned. Now you know that when that warranty card in the box, you know, and the nice sales lady says, be sure to fill out the warranty card. Why don't you fill that warranty card out right now, and I'll take it and mail it in for you? Does that nice sales lady there in the store understand adhesion contracts, bilateral agreements, unilateral agreements, limited liability, underwriter? Does she understand that? No. Has she been programmed to tell you, be sure you fill out that warranty card. Here, fill it out and give it to me, and I'll mail it in for you. She's taught, trained to do that. She's brainwashed, just like the rest of us, you know, from kindergarten up. So insurance companies, along with banks and government agencies and government in general, they train the entire consuming public to accept and buy these products, these services. So when you open the discussion and you say insurance should be banned, immediately you know that the guy that makes a statement like insurance should be banned, you know this guy is some kind of a radicalized kook. Hell, you know better than that. Well, do you really, or have you just been preconditioned to believe that? Or do you really know that based upon some kind of independent research? All right, so now with that out of the way, let me tell you another little story over here as it relates to these insurance companies. And I call it the Amil Crow story. Amil Crow was a claims adjuster for the Travelers Insurance Company, and he was an independent adjuster working the southern tier counties here in Missouri, probably Ozark County, so back in 1950. Now, Amil Crow isn't just a claims adjuster, he's also a licensed attorney. His real business is he's a licensed attorney, but he needs to augment his income since he's just fresh out of law school. And so he takes on an independent insurance claims adjusting agency so that any insurance company that has business here with the policyholders in this region of the country, they have somebody that can go out and investigate their claims, and they will pay them on a commission. Now, when I was trained for this, normally the insurance company would put you on salary. They pay you $500 a month, and you have an office, and you're actually working for the insurance company. Now, there are independent claims adjusters, but most of them are accompaniment. We're actually working for the company. Now, it happens that the Travelers Company, not having too many policyholders in this region of the country, hired Amil, you know, from time to time to investigate an accident. And so, sure enough, one of their policyholders had an accident, and it appeared that the Travelers policyholder was, in fact, at fault. And it was a big policy, $50,000 policy. Now, taking this into perspective here, back in the 1950s, if you had a $5,000, $10,000 policy, that was normal. If you had a $10,000, $20,000, that was pretty good size. If you had a $20,000, $40,000, you know, that was humongous. To have a $50,000 policy, now, I don't know if it was $50,000. See, they used to have this spread in here. If it was some kind of an accident, they'd pay you double, kind of like double indemnity. It's kind of like double down, you know, when you're playing blackjack. And then you come up with a pair of aces you can split. But sometimes, you know, you can come up with a pair and you can double down, one card and double down. Okay, well, anyway, this is a big policy. It's $50,000. Now, the job of the claims adjuster, the claims manager, is to go out and determine who's at fault and to limit the company's liability as much as possible. And if it warrants it, to offer a settlement and to settle the thing out of court. So Emil goes out, takes a look at it, and his preliminary investigation says to him, he says, hey, listen, we're liable, and this is a bad accident. We're not only liable, we're liable for the whole $50,000. Furthermore, this accident could cost more than $50,000. It could be $60,000 or $70,000 because of the damage. Nobody got killed, surprisingly. But several people got injured, and they were injured severely. So we have, and I don't know what the severity of the injuries are. I can't tell you that they were paraplegics or quadriplegics. So I didn't get into that. But severe injuries is what run this bill up so high. You know, two cars back in 1950, you know, $5,000 to buy both of them brand new, assuming they were new. But the injuries here, the lifetime permanent injuries over here, ran this bill up pretty high. And our insured is the guy who is guilty here, and we're going to have to pay. Now, remember, if you got a $50,000 policy and you got a $60,000 casualty, the insurance company doesn't pay $60. They only pay $50. They only pay up to the policy limit. That's what the contract calls for. That's all they're going to pay. But they have to defend the case in court. And this is why you buy these insurance policies. It's because, you know, they're going to hire the best lawyer that money can buy. They're going to hire Jerry Spence or somebody like him to defend the insurance company. So when you go into court against an insurance company, you are going into court against the best lawyer money can buy. They're absolutely at the pinnacle of their career. The insurance company has the money, and their intention is to defeat you. Their intention is to pay you absolutely nothing. The objective of Emil Crow and the Travelers Insurance Company, after their ward, their policyholder, caused $50,000 plus damages, is to pay the victim not one penny. And then on the other side, the victim over here, his job, his intention, his motivation is to collect the entire $50,000 plus a deficiency judgment and make the perpetrator pay him the whole $60,000 or $70,000 and every last farthing thereto. And this process is called the adversarial system. It's not a justice system. You see, you've been to kindergarten and first grade, and everybody told you about justice. Now, justice is the system that we use under the Ten Commandment model, and then God uses the word just and justice. But under the Ten Plank model, we don't practice justice. We practice adversarial system. The adversarial system is where two combatants come into the ring, like two gladiators in a Roman arena. And one of them is going to win, and one of them is going to lose. That's the system that we call justice today, which is why insurance companies, when they owe you $100,000, on average pay $11,000. It's the adversarial system. It has nothing to do with justice. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here at the midway point that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archive, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page and download it right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we're citing here and promoting on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, or sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us here at the law school direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about limited liability. Limited liability is insurance, and most of us have insurance or have had insurance in the past. And so we're investigating insurance limited liability to see what the other side of the coin is. Because in the Bible, limited liability, that is insurance, is strictly prohibited. Now, Christians and religious people all have insurance. I'm not sure that they have insurance because they hate God and do not want to obey Him. I don't think that's their motivation. I think that they have insurance because they've been told by their preachers and teachers and school teachers and family that it's the logical thing to do and it's good, and there's nothing in the Bible that prohibits it, and so therefore it's good. And besides that, the Old Testament's been nailed to the cross with Jesus and taken out of the way, so we don't have to follow that law anyway. Now, those are false premises. False premises. But people believe false premises. And most of the time, it probably is harmless. You know, you can stop and think about it this way. The banning of drunk drivers from the highway. Well, you know, you could ban people from the highway who use their cell phones. And they're talking about that now in some states, I think, have introduced that kind of legislation. They say, we don't want people talking on the telephone driving down the road at the same time. Now, because it's a distraction. Well, let me ask you this. If you're driving down the road and you're pushing the buttons into your GPS thingy over here, aren't you distracted? When you're putting a CD into your CD player, or you're putting a tape in, or you're changing stations, you know, on your radio, aren't you distracted? So, you know, I don't know. I guess we could pick just about anything that we wanted. You know, picking your nose, I guess, could distract you. And if the policeman sees you picking your nose driving down the highway, why, he wants to stop you and give you a ticket. He wants to stop you and give you a ticket if you don't have your seatbelt buckled. And, you know, there's all of these rules and regulations. Well, all these rules and regulations are enacted by legislators and governments at the behest of the insurance industry. It's the insurance industry that sends their lobbyists into the halls of Congress and your legislatures to get these things enacted or banned, because it impacts upon the claims window of the insurance industry. You see, we've been taught when we go to kindergarten that the purpose for insurance is to protect people. And insurance companies are the vehicles that we use to protect these people from financial loss. And it's good for everybody to have insurance, because if everybody has insurance, well, then we've got a pool of money over here that we can pay out to the injured victim. See, that's what you're taught when you go to school. Now, we put this into the hands of a private business called insurance. And the purpose for business is to make profit. A business does not exist for any other purpose than making profit. That's it. They're not there to equalize losses and damages and employ people, and they're not there for that purpose at all. It is true, they employ people and they alleviate damages and all kinds of good things come out of it, but that's not the reason they're there. They're there to make profit. Now, the guy that's running this profit-making enterprise over there, he sits down with people every Tuesday in a board meeting, and they talk about ways that they can increase profits and cut costs. And somebody comes in and suggests that what we need is a seatbelt law, because when there's an accident, these people go through the windshields and it causes us a lot of money. And over in Sweden, where we pioneered seatbelts, we find that less people or fewer people go through the windshields, and therefore if we can keep them in the car, we have less damages. And so they go to the legislature and say, hey, we can save lives. We can save injuries. But the insurance company isn't going into the legislature because they're motivated by saving lives and preventing injuries. Their motivation is to collect premiums and pay out no claims. Now, if in the process of collecting premiums and paying out no claims, we save lives and injuries, that's a beneficial side effect. But it's not the reason that the insurance company is in the halls of Congress legislating and lobbying for these changes in the law. Now, with that in mind, let's go back to Amel Crow. Amel's job here is to limit the liability of the company. In fact, the company gears Amel's compensation to his performance. And the way Amel's going to get paid now, the insurance company says to Amel, now you're a private entrepreneur, and we want to pay out as few dollars as we possibly can. So what we're going to do is we're going to pay you 50% of every dollar that you save the company. So watch this. Amel goes out, investigates the wreck, comes to the conclusion that we're liable for $50,000. If Amel could settle this claim for $40,000, he would save the company $10,000, and the company would keep $5,000 of that and pay Amel $5,000. So Amel's going to get paid $5,000 if he can settle this claim for $40,000. Now, what if Amel could settle the case for $30,000? Well, then he would save the company $20,000, the company would keep $10,000, and Amel would make $10,000. Well, what if they could settle this case for $20,000. Well, then he would save the company $30,000 and the company would keep $15,000 and pay Amel $15,000. So you can see that Amel has a goal in mind. He has an incentive to pay this guy as little as possible. And if it was possible, we'd pay him zero, wouldn't we? Now, we've got to pay him something. I mean, after all, he's in the hospital, and our guy over here got a ticket because he was driving on the wrong side of the road and hit this guy head-on, and he's obviously at fault. So what we do here is Amel goes to the hospital. This guy's in the hospital now for 2 or 3 months, along with his wife and children and so on. He goes to the hospital and he says, hey, you're in safe hands with Travelers Insurance. Gives the guy an umbrella, I guess, and gets a statement. He says, hey, what happened? And let me help you with your claim. Our guy over here caused you a damage, and we want to pay you. Now, Amel does not tell this guy that the policy limit is $50,000. In fact, that policy limit will be guarded like the atomic secrets. Nobody is going to reveal, not even on discovery, are we going to tell anybody what the policy limit is. That's so that the other side never knows how much is in the game. They don't know what we're playing for. And they presume, you know, that maybe we're playing for 5 to 10, maybe even 10, 20, you know. So Amel goes in and says, hey, we want to help you in any way we can. And so he gets a statement. He comes back. Now, Amel deliberately does not pay this guy for 90 days. He takes his claim, they process it, and they go through it. Remember the average daily balance rule. We owe this guy $60,000, or $50,000. That's our policy limit. We owe him $50,000. We'll just take $50,000 times 0.10. That's $5,000 divided by 360 days in a year. That's $13.88 a day times 90 days. So in the first 90 days, we made $1,250. So by not paying this guy on day one, we actually now, when we do pay this guy, we're going to actually have paid him $1,250 less because we made that much interest off of his money that we haven't given him yet. Isn't that special? All right. Now this guy, at some point in time, gets out of the hospital. He goes home. He's recuperating. Now he's lost his job. His car is gone. He hasn't made his house payments for 3 months. And so now he's facing foreclosure. He is in desperate financial condition. Desperate financial condition, DFC, desperate financial condition. And he who has the gold makes the rules. And this is a part of the insurance company's strategy. We want to make you so financially desperate that when we make our offer to you, you're more likely to accept it. And so as time progresses along, Amel comes to the guy and says, now listen, our investigation shows that there's contributory negligence in this case. That is, it is true that our man crossed the center line and hit your car. But it's also true that you were drunk while you were driving, and that's contributory negligence. Now, it doesn't have to be true. This guy can be stone cold sober. He can be a Mormon mission, you know, a Mormon bishop on a mission, and we would accuse him of being drunk. But the point I'm making is that if there's contributory negligence and we go to trial, you may end up like the two ladies in the hedge fire with getting a $1 judgment, you know. If this thing goes to trial, there's no guarantee that you're going to walk out of here the winners. To show you how this is done, insurance companies keep statistics on jury settlements. And there's no such thing as 100%. So as an example, they'll take a look at a case like this and they'll say, well, if we go to trial 100 times, we're going to lose 70% of the time and we're going to win 30. Or we're going to lose 80% of the time, but the 20% of the time that we win, we're going to pay half as much. And so you plug these numbers in, and it tells you whether or not we want to go to trial or settle out of court. And it also tells us how much we want to settle out of court for, because it may well be that statistically, when we take this case to trial, even if we lose at trial and we get a jury award against us, it'll be less than we would settle out of court for under the terms that the other side wants. So this is called the art of negotiation. It is true, we got a policy limit of 50 grand, but that doesn't mean that we're going to let you know what we're playing for, and it doesn't say that we're going to settle for the 50. We're going to settle for something less than that, and everybody knows that. So Amel comes in, and he says, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. In spite of the contributory negligence, we're prepared to pay you $7,500 right now today, and I'll write the check. And this guy is just incensed. He is just so mad that he says, get out of my house, and I'm going to call a lawyer, and we're going to see about this. And so this guy, you know, the victim, he goes out and hires a lawyer, which is exactly what Amel wants to do, because, you see, nobody wants to deal with the victim. He's been hurt, and he wants to be compensated. So he goes out and he hires a fellow whore. Now, Amel's a whore, and this guy goes out and hires a fellow whore. Now, you got two whores over here figuring out what they're going to do with this John, you know, the victim. So the victim now and his lawyer comes over to Amel, and they have a meeting or two, and then they go out on the golf links to settle the case. And so Amel says to the victim's lawyer, here's what the story is. There's a $20,000 policy limit, and we're guilty, and we don't deny it, and we're going to settle with you. Now, if we take this case to trial, you know, we might win and we might lose, or we might win a 70%, 60%, 50%. Might get a contributory negligence damage award or something. But I'll tell you what we're going to do. I get paid based upon what I save the company, and there's a $20,000 limit. So if you'll settle a case for $17,000, leave $3,000 on the table, the company gets $1,500 and I get $1,500, and you get one third. And so from that perspective, if you settle, fine, and if you don't, we'll go to trial. So the opposing counsel, now, he's not told what the policy limit is either, and $20,000 would be about double normal. $5,000 would be normal. $10,000-$20,000 would be big. And nobody is thinking about, my God, this thing could be, you know, $20,000-$40,000 or, you know, $30,000-$50,000 or something like that. So they come to an agreement. The lawyer for the victim comes to the victim and says, okay, now here's where it's at. The guy that caused you this damage is a bricklayer, and he doesn't have any money. He rents an apartment, and his car is destroyed, and he's out of work too. But he does have an insurance policy, and it's a $20,000 policy, which is a big policy, and they will settle with you out of court for $17,000. And if you accept the $17,000 award, you pay me one-third of the $17,000. If it was $18,000, it'd be $6,000, so it's going to be $5,500 or thereabouts. Now, remember, Emil offered this guy $7,500. He got mad, so he hired the attorney. And so, assuming they got $18,000, the lawyer gets $6,000, and this guy's going to get $12,000, which is, you know, $4,500 bucks more than he was going to get from Emil. And, you know, people, if they could do their own negotiations, you know, if the lawyer could negotiate this deal and get $17,000, how come the guy that's the victim can't negotiate this deal and get $17,000? Well, it's because he doesn't know how to negotiate. He does not have Wenke's book on the art of negotiation. See? I do. And so I tell my students, you know, when you get into negotiations over here, there's a formula that you use for determining how much we're going to settle for. I could sit down with an insurance adjuster over a settlement conference or in a settlement conference, and I can tell you, you know, within 5 percentage points as to how much the maximum amount the insurance company is going to settle for before they take it to trial. And I can also look it up, and I can tell you how much the average jury award is going to be in your region of the country. Did you know that there's a way of determining that? Statistics are kept, and they're not kept by insurance companies exclusively either. And I did a case, I advised a student here on a case one time, and we looked it up, and I said, the average jury award in cases like yours is about $2.2 million. And he was very excited, and he said, boy, that's $2.2 million. But I said, the insurance company isn't going to settle for $2.2 million. The real cash value of your claim is about $500,000. If you want to settle out of court today, it's $500,000. Now, if you want more than $500,000 and you want to go for the full $2.2 million, which is the average in cases like this, then we'll take it to trial, but you won't get paid for at least 7 years. You will not get your check for 7 years. The insurance company will keep this case in litigation. And remember the rule of 72? Right. So if we take the rule of 72 and divide that by 10, it's 7.2 years. So the insurance company will pay you nothing out of their capital, but they will pay you the interest that they earn off of their capital for the 7.2 years, which means that if they can stall you off for 7.2 years, they will pay you zero. That didn't take anything out of their pocket. That's the reason why the judicial system is so slow in the administration of justice. It's because it's controlled by the insurance companies, and the insurance companies play the game by the rule of 72. Now, if you'll settle for $500,000, it will equal what we're going to make anyway, so we'll go ahead and settle for the $500,000 today rather than risk the $2.2 million over the next 7 years, because it makes economic sense for us to do that. So anytime you're negotiating with the insurance company, it has to make economic sense for the insurance company. And if it doesn't, then you're going to trial. And if you go to trial, you ain't getting paid for 7.2 years. You'll win on average the $2.2 million, but you ain't going to spend a dime of it until 7 years from now. So if you're 82 years old, you know, you got to put that into the equation and then ask yourself, well, is that what I want to do? See how this game is being played here, boys and girls? So in the final analysis, it took some negotiation, but the victim settled for the $17,000. Now, here's what the final numbers are. The man who is the victim, who was entitled to be paid the $50,000, $60,000, or $70,000, gets paid $17,000. So he does not get justice at all. Secondly, the attorney for the victim gets paid $6,000 for doing the negotiations. Never did any trial work, never got into the, just to negotiate it. And the victim gets $12,000, or a little less. He gets more than he was initially offered, but hell, he could have come in and got $17,000 just like his lawyer did, which still wouldn't have been adequate, but it would have been more had he just had Wenke's book on negotiation and had the gumption to go negotiate for himself. Furthermore, if he had stuck by his gun and said, let's go litigate the case, he would have received a judgment for the $50,000. Well, statistically and on average, he would have. The jury probably would have given him the $60,000. He would be sitting there then with the full $50,000, not a penny less. Emil Kroh would be sitting there with nothing because he didn't save the company any money. And that's what his agreement with the company is. Now, Emil knows that he can settle these cases every time, and he'll always make more money than nothing. The insurance company does this because by giving the claims adjuster an incentive package, the claims adjuster will be out there working as hard as he can to settle for the lowest possible dollar. It's a win-win for everybody, well, except the victim. But then, this is not a justice system, this is an adversarial system. We're playing a game here, and we presume that you, the victim, are playing the game to win, just like we're playing the game to win. Now, watch what Emil Kroh gets. He saves the company $33,000, so he gets paid $16,500. And the insurance company gets paid $16,500. Now, watch this. Emil Kroh gets paid more than the victim. He gets paid more than the victim for negotiating this abortion to start with and screwing this guy out of his settlement. Isn't that just special? I thought you'd like that. Now, if you're wondering why God, our Creator, has such a bad opinion about bankers, politicians, and preachers, and lawyers, and this is just one example. I could tell you stories and stories and stories, boys and girls, until the cows come home. And so can the claims adjusters, and so can the lawyers, and so can the insurance companies. I mean, we can tell you about all the stories about how we've screwed you people out of your money. You pay your premiums, and then we screw you out of your benefits. And we do it with a straight face. And we do it, and we go out to dinner, and we talk to our peers, and we tell stories about, well, if you think that was good, hey, listen to this story. Let me tell you about the settlement that I made when I screwed the victim out of, you see. And then we brag about it. Brag about it. I've got a better story than that. I screwed a widow and her little children out of twice as much money as that. Listen to this. Well, that's the way insurance works, and that's the name of that game. So hang on. I've got to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archive. And all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.